Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Yeah, we have a show to do, Paul Vallis. Hi, Amy Jacobson here in for Dan Proft, and Paul Vallis is joining us this morning. How are you doing?
Good.
Good, good. All right, well, you got to talk into the mic.
I know, it's early.
And then press the button. But you've been very busy, though, because you're working on, I mean, a lot of people don't know this, and I hope we can talk about this. You're helping out the police contract with the city of Chicago.
Yes, I've been helping the FOP in negotiations.
Okay, and you're doing this pro bono?
Yes.
Why?
I don't want anyone to question my motivations here.
Okay, but how's it going? Because it's been a few months, almost.
It's gone well. I know that the FOP has a deal with the mayor's negotiating team. It's really now up to the mayor and, of course, the city council. But remember, the FOP president, John Catanzara, still has to bring that to his membership, too. But I think it's a very fair, affordable deal, and hopefully, and the mayor's team, there's been long negotiations. I think I pointed out, I myself have had over 100 email exchanges. So if anyone wants to doubt,
can we FOIA these emails?
That's right, about whether we've been negotiating
we'll
seriously. Just answer the emails. No, but we've been negotiating quite seriously, at least since my arrival. And I'm sure that there were intense negotiations prior to my arrival. So I've tried to assist, and I feel from an outsider standpoint, I think it's a long overdue contract.
Yeah, haven't they been working
4 years?
4 years without a contract?
4 years without, that's right. 4 years without a pay increase, 4 years without a contract.
Do you know what the sticking points are, or can you not discuss that?
Well, I think, clearly what we wanted to do was to, there are so many issues that needed to be addressed. I think the objective here was to have a financial package that was affordable but was very reasonable in terms of getting the police officers their retro pay, their bump in pay, and then just not suddenly we're done with one contract and we're into a we have a delayed second contract. So the idea here was to negotiate really two contracts, the four-year retro contract, because remember, to your listeners, police have been without a contract for 4 years, but then to extend that contract into the future. So it's an 8-year contract. And then, obviously there were some accountability issues that the mayor wanted to address. Those accountability issues that the FOP president can speak more specifically to, they mirror what was in the sergeant's contract that was
great.
Already negotiated, approved by the mayor and approved by the city
council. So the police officer is going to get a bump in pay?
Yeah, the police officers
right away when the contract kicks in?
Yes, they would get a bump in pay.
Because have they gotten any raises in 4 years?
Nothing. Other than the step increases, the longevity increases. But what they would do is they would get their retro, a 4-year retro check. They would get their 4-year retro pay. And let me point out, we also took out the provisions that actually punished newer officers, because newer officers used to have to wait, I think it's 42 months before they get their duty availability pay. Well, we've now changed that to they get it right after they're off probation. I think that's 18 months. But they would not only get that, but they would get it retro. So they would not only get the retro pay for duty availability, the retro pay for the salary increases, but then there'd be an immediate bump. There would be an immediate bump in their salaries. And then, the good news is there's then it's actually 3.5-year contract extension that gives them reasonable pay increases. So it's a long overdue contract.
Wow. And how many hours do you think you've put into this?
Enough, but it's been thoroughly enjoyable. And of course,
Yeah, because you have a son who's a police officer San Antonio.
My two sons were police officer. The one is now a firefighter. And my wife was a police officer. And of course, my dad's only sibling was a 36-year police officer, almost three-decade homicide detective. He passed away a couple years ago. But so, yeah, we have police officers in the family.
That's great. Well, good for you and good for the city of Chicago, because I can't imagine being a police officer right now.
Oh, my God.
I mean, how many have been shot at? 36 have been shot at.
Well,
total
this
year, this year alone, the lack of respect for police and those videos that are going nationwide of people, you know, girls doing like twerking on top of SUV police squad cars.
And I call it.
It's just sickening. What do you call it?
Chicago's version of community policing.
Oh, yeah. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line 64636. Type in DA, then a quick question. I don't know anybody who would want to sign up to be a police officer right now, because make one bad mistake and you could lose your pension, you could lose your job, too, but also you could go to jail, and then you lose your family.
Well, you know, they've almost criminalized really minor, you know, minor things. And of course, in the bill, the so-called Justice Reform Act at the Pritzker side. So they've almost criminalized policing. But, you know, that's a field day for the lawyers, because Big Cottage Industry is suing the city. I mean, oh, my God. And people don't realize how much we've paid out in lawsuits. And, you know, they like to blame the cops. But sometimes, I mean, I blame the city a lot of times for settling on these cases. And some of the cases are legitimate. But, you know, they pay out these settlements like it's, well, it isn't their money. It's taxpayers' money.
Right.
Yeah, $3 million here, $2 million here, $1 million here, $4 million here. And what people don't realize is in the last 10 years, about almost $100 million of the money involved in these settlements has gone to law firms, not suing the city, law firms settling on the city behalf, on the city's behalf.
Oh, so they're working, okay.
That's right. So what happens is the law department hires law firms to settle these cases. Right. So, you know, it's big money. It's like I call it the money monster. And so suing the city has become a cottage industry.
Wow. All right. Well, before we get to the newsroom, we want to talk to Mike Scott and bring him in here, because whenever Paul fills in or anybody else, we're a little more human here, and we want to do follow-ups. Because your wife, Melissa, was going through, she had cancer at probably the worst time ever during when the pandemic hit, and we just wanted to get an update how she's doing.
She's fine. We're inventing new ways to have tests every month now, because you have these new full body breast scans that they do that are completely different than anything they've ever done before. And these are every 3 to 6 months checkup she's required to have for the next 5 years. And CAT scans and all these things that are just part of our life now. But she's healthy. She's good. We're fabulous as a family. And it's been...
Has it brought you guys closer together?
I think so. Yeah, but in different ways. In much different ways than before. We were always close. But, you know, cancer forces you to, as a husband who doesn't have cancer, supporting a wife who does have cancer, it is it's a very different role to play. You not only become provider, you become supporter, but you also have to be a parent for children who lose about 50% of one parent. Because Melissa had to recover from treatment or from surgery or from things like that. So it's a different role. You grow closer because you learn different and new things about yourself. And a lot of those things carry over into your relationship going forward.
And did you have to take her to all of her appointments?
No, we couldn't. We were banned from, she had to go all alone.
That just seems so, can you imagine going through that by yourself? Because when you go see a doctor and you get a diagnosis like that, you need somebody with you to take notes, because you're out of your mind. I mean, I'd have somebody go with me with Russell because I couldn't.
Oh, yeah.
You can't function. I mean, you can function
you
and
you'd
be strong. Or Eli, excuse me. but you can be strong, but you can't.
Sure.
You've got to have a list of questions that you need to ask the neurosurgeons and the doctors and all that.
Sure. Paul knows this as well. There's a bureaucracy everywhere.
There is.
And there's a bureaucracy you have to fight a little bit, even undergoing cancer treatment. And a bureaucracy that we could not fight, put in place by Governor Pritzker, was the ban on elective surgeries. And cancer was considered a ban on elective, was considered part of elective surgeries at this point. And some hospitals fought back and allowed at least one person to go with. But a lot of hospital corporations did not. Ours chose to not and allow a second person in. So two major surgeries, and then all the treatments until the last one, which was done at Loyola. Loyola was very generous. They allowed at least a partner or a spouse to go with. Loyola did it pretty
well.
That's crazy.
I mean, that is insane. What we did to people, what we let our government do to us, is a shame.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer.
Your show keeps me alive during the week. There's nobody I'd rather listen to between 5 and 9 in the morning than you guys.
On AM 560, The Answer. If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560, The Answer.
All right, dude man just spilled coffee on his brand new shirt. And what are you going to... You're going to wear that for the rest of the day, right?
I do. I have to be dressed up today.
Where are you going?
Oh, to the...
You got to talk into the mic, Paul.
There you go.
Get close.
I know. I'm so clumsy in the morning. I don't know how you do it. I don't know, you know. Of course, see, you go to bed at 8 o'clock when you have these shows.
I mean, I try to.
I still stay up till midnight, so.
Oh, I see. So you're nocturnal. But can I take a picture of that?
Yeah, go ahead. Go ahead.
So you have to... Oh, Paul, we should get you...
A bib.
A bib might be
I'm
start,
so clumsy.
But we need to clean your shirt.
I mean, with all these electronics here, I'm surprised I haven't electrocuted myself yet. All the things I spilled.
312-642-5600. Turnkey.pro. Answer line 64636. Type in DA. Then a quick comment. We were talking about the police and the contract that you're working on between the FOP and the city. And today she's going to announce a civilian oversight board. So wait, we got COPA.
COPA.
Then we have that, or is that part of COPA?
Well, it's new. So we have COPA, the police board. Of course, we have the FBI's here.
And
of course,
we have the DOJ.
We have DOJ and, of course, the
state
attorney's office and the inspector general. Of course, inspector general. And I know there's one or two others. I just haven't thought of them. I have to go to my list of police oversight agencies.
So why do we need another oversight agency?
That's a good question. You know, fortunately... I think the mayor has veto power over their recommendations. But it's kind of a convoluted process. They make recommendations. The mayor could override. There are some things that the city council can override. So it's another oversight entity. You know, how about getting COPA to do their job, assuming they're not doing their job, or the police board to do their job? Remember, COPA was intended to be a form of civilian oversight, I guess. That's what it's
called.
It would
be hard for me to do my job, but if I had that many agencies overlording my work.
Yeah. Meanwhile, crime is not de-escalating, and, you know, the mayor's efforts, we had another violent weekend, and it's they don't have enough detectives, they're letting too many people out, they're just not prosecuting to the degree that they should be, and you know, there's no accountability here.
And one thing that people should not forget is when COVID happened and the lockdown started, Pritzker, the governor, let 4,000 nonviolent offenders out of jail. They can't go back into jail until he stops with this emergency declaration. Every month on a Friday night at about 5 or 6 when no one's looking, he secretly signs it again, extending it. We're now on 16 months.
Right.
And if he signs it again at the end of July, and when we have Lollapalooza the next day, then we all know what an absolute joke this has been the entire time. And of those 4,000 that are out, 64 are murderers. 64 murderers are out.
Do you think this is going to show up in his commercials? Can't believe he's running political commercials. And they all have a COVID focus, how I rescued the state from COVID.
Yeah, try to stomach this, Paul, because I know you didn't. You can hear it now.
When I ran for governor 4 years ago, I could not have imagined that I would end up leading the state through a global pandemic. Look, I may not have gotten every decision right, but at every step along the way, I followed the science and focused on protecting the lives and livelihoods of the people of Illinois. I can't tell you what pride it gives me as governor of this state to see the people of Illinois standing up for one another. We saw the fundamental goodness of the people of Illinois exists in southern Illinois as it does in central Illinois, as it does in northern Illinois. Part of why I'm running for re-election is because I watched the hero.
Touching all those bases.
It was 3 minutes long, and all it talked about was COVID. Nothing else that he's done in his first term in office. And he did one-on-ones yesterday with reporters that he likes, that he trusts. One being Marianne Ahern, and, you know, he talked about how difficult it was every day to be the governor.
Wake up every morning, and I look at those numbers, and when they're rising, you know, that's a bad day.
And he said in his campaign ad that, you know, there's some things I did wrong. So I texted Marianne Ahern because I can't get access to him. I said, well, what did he, what, you know, in his campaign ad, he said, there's some things I did wrong. What did he do wrong? And she said, well, that he didn't implement the mask mandate earlier.
Oh, my God.
And I thought of our good friend Justin Kosick. Because he loves the masks, that guy. Well, he's a mask enthusiast from there. He's our technical producer.
Yeah, that's an easy one. You know, I'll say two things he did wrong. His blanket shutting down of the service industry, I thought was a disaster because it really created depression-like conditions in the poor communities. And you know, look, I mean, Democrats, and yet who was punished most? From two actions. One is to just the across the board shutdown of the service industry, poor people. And in Chicago, overwhelmingly black and Latino. And of course, not too courageous on getting schools to reopen, not following the science there.
No, he could have been like Governor DeSantis and demanded every school district have in-person learning from the beginning.
Miami-Dade opened, you know, no adverse effects. The Archdiocese opened their schools.
Well, Catholics don't get COVID.
Yeah. What? Three children in Chicago died of COVID-related illnesses, but yet
they were in the hospital anyway.
They were in the hospital and they had pre-existing conditions. And I'm not, you know, the loss of any child. You know, so I'm not minimizing that. But since COVID, how many kids have been killed on the streets of Chicago, school-age kids? Are we approaching 100 since COVID?
Well, 201 have been shot
since this year.
January.
Last year, 567 were shot. So, I mean...
And dead, I'm so sorry.
Well, last year...
I think it's 16 right now.
Last year, 87 were killed last year through, I think, mid-December, the last numbers I had and that I saw. And, of course, is it 16? But, I mean, really? You don't think... I went back and I counted last year the number of students who were killed during the hours then when they might have been in school. And it was at least, I think, 14 or 15. So please spare me. And the loss, the academic loss, the impact on working families, only one in six black and Latino families can work from home. It had a devastating impact. But that's,
and don't think that we're out of the woods yet.
No, we're not.
What is the threshold to put those mitigations in place? How many cases does it need to be at?
I think you've seen that, you know, we've used a variety of thresholds, including the positivity rate, including the numbers of cases.
And what is that
rate? We're watching very closely the hospitalizations.
And we're going to get into that at 6 a.m. And we'll take your phone calls, too, because according to Mayor Lightfoot, there's another round of lockdowns right around the corner.
Right around the corner.
Nothing makes sense here. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line 64636. Type in DA, then a quick comment. Let's go to Greg in Mount Greenwood. You join us on Chicago's Morning Answer. Good morning, Craig.
Hey, Amy. Good morning. Good to hear you again. And your partner, Paul. My question for you is regarding the contract. And, you know, you got all these leftists that are sprinkled through that whole process with... you know, looking over the police and going after them and that. Is there anything in the contract to help protect police from the abuses that they get?
Yeah, well, you know, I can let John speak better to that issue than me, you know, because I don't want to do that deep a dive and I don't want to get ahead of him. Mm-hmm. You know, but there are many things that they wanted to include in this contract that the police opposed, as well as things that the police were demanding that we've pushed off into the next set of negotiations. So what we did on the accountability side was really focus on the accountability provisions that mirrored what was in the sergeant's contract and many of the other things. With some language clarification, but many of the other things that the city was demanding, that other people were demanding, we just pushed off into a new set of negotiations because we felt it was important to get the financial side of the deal done while at the same time giving the mayor what she was able to secure through the sergeants with some clarifications so that we could get people paid, get them compensated, and then deal with these many other issues in a new set of negotiations that would be separate and a part of the ratification of the contract that we like to think that the city is soon to agree to.
And what do you think about this new gun tactical team that's going to come and just focus?
It's smoke and mirrors.
Let's hear Superintendent Brown.
We're going to use this $1 million fund to create tips to out you. Someone knows who's being paid as a third party to purchase guns for a violent person in the city that would do a drive-by shooting on young people celebrating graduation.
Look, you know, this is more smoke and mirrors. You know, they do they're going to have a $1 million, you know, bounty program. What's that going to do? I mean, you know, what's that going to do? That's going to, that's going to reduce the violent crime rate. It's like creating these, like, special anti-gun detective units. I mean, they gutted the detectives division. They shut in his reorganization. They not only pulled officers from the beats, 20% reduction in officers in the districts, but they got rid of those area support teams, which included gun teams, drug, and gang teams. So it's just small. Look, any press conference that they have that doesn't have a plan to increase the number of detectives, that doesn't have a plan to protect witness protection, and that it doesn't have Fox and the judges there standing there and committing to not only denying bail to, like, serious offenders, but also prosecuting and also giving these people long sentences. Any press conference that doesn't have those things is not a serious press conference about fighting gun violence.
Mike on the north side, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer. Good morning, Mike.
Good morning. Paul, you're out. You missed the dinner at the club on July 3rd. I cooked beef tenderloin, shrimp on the Barbie, two salads for $7. I could solve all these financial problems. You missed it. I want to say Chicago's crime problem is created by the politicians. They don't want to go after the criminals.
Right.
They're going right at them. And it's not a white supremacy problem. No one will say it. It's a black supremacy problem. The blacks are running the criminal justice system, and they're going right on criminals. This wouldn't happen. But you've got Lori Lightfoot. You got Tim Fox. You got this guy from Dallas who doesn't know what he's doing as a police superintendent, and they're letting the criminals go. And this is what Chicago voted for. This is what Chicago wanted. This is what you got. Until you start electing conservatives and people who are going to be tough on crime, this is it. You can make all the teams up you want, but when the cops are not allowed to put their hands on people, put the fear of God into people, and arrest people who are committing crimes, driving around with a gun, if you are not allowed to do it legally, is a crime. And they try to blame white supremacy for everything. Let me tell you something. They brought up this Asian hate crime stuff, and then they found out most of the people committing hate crimes are young blacks. So they dropped that. Sure. Now they're talking about guns flooding into the city. How did it get here? The gangbangers send their family members and their girlfriends who don't have records to buy them. But when they start arresting and they find out it's all black people, oh, we can't do this. This is racist. They would rather have crime and rather your family members be victims than to do their jobs.
Well said, Mike.
It's what Chicago is talking about. It's Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan and Amy on AM 560, The Answer.
All right, so CTU, quickly, they want 4,000 new workers, Paul?
4,200 new workers. Now, remember, they lost, 15,000 students last year. And incidentally, if you go to CPS's website and you see it from last year, one teacher for every 16 students they have currently, and one employee for every 8, and now they want 4,200 more employees or CTU members. So, you know, I mean, this COVID money is not going to last forever.
But they want a piece of the COVID money. And they also want assistance with low-income housing.
Yes.
It's the same jargon as last time when we were threatening whether or not to go back to school.
Right.
You know, but I don't want anybody to ever forget. They're the ones who said, well, just give us one shot and then we'll go back to high school. Then after the first shot, well, now we want two. And they took shots away from people who needed them. So shame on them. They took shots away from my dad, other people's parents, and people with comorbidities. People died because of them. And I will never, ever forgive them for that.
They're also still making demands to allow some of their individuals to work remotely. So there's still all sorts of provisions in there. And again, you know, now they have newfound power. They can strike for virtually any reason. Courtesy of Governor Pritzker, I wonder if that's going to be in his commercial, too.
Because he wants to buy the votes, the unions.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer.
Your show keeps me alive during the week. There's nobody I'd rather listen to between 5 and 9 in the morning than you guys.
On AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Doom and gloom. That's what you get every time you talk to these politicians. I mean, it is unbelievable. Hi, Amy Jacobson here, and for Dan Proft, Paul Vallis, and for Dan Proft, actually. Thank you for coming in.
My pleasure.
And yesterday, you know, I always go to these news conferences because I go as a reporter, but also as a Chicagoan and as a concerned parent who's on edge every night because we're just waiting for the IDPH to release their new guidelines for the fall. We know we're scheduled to go back 5 days a week, beginning a week early. I think August 30th we go back. But what's school going to look like in the fall? Are we going to be wearing masks? Do we have to wear masks? Dr. Awardi was asked that question.
Let me remind people that Monday, in terms of deadlines, is also if you want your child over the age of 12 fully vaccinated by the time CPS starts, Monday's your deadline. So if you've got a 12 to 17-year-old, remember, fully vaccinated means 2 weeks post your second dose. And for 12 to 17-year-olds, Pfizer is the only vaccine that is available.
Then we ask again, should masks, if you're fully vaccinated, and over the age of 12, should you be wearing masks during school?
So certainly we are in conversations with CPS and with all of the other private and parochial schools here in Chicago. What I will tell you is that I was pleased with the CDC guidance that came out around schools. First and foremost, they said we want to show, you know, from a data-driven perspective, children should be in school in person. And I think you know this is something that the Chicago Department of Public Health has been really encouraging in a data-driven way for months and months and months and months. And they really said this should be a decision at a local level. I want to be clear that nothing has happened to the CDC guidance that said unvaccinated people need to continue to mask. And I will also say in Chicago, like I showed, less than half of adolescents have gotten a first dose and less than a third are fully vaccinated, or just over a third are fully vaccinated. And so there are real operational questions around what it would look like in a setting to make that decision.
So the answer is she doesn't have an answer.
She doesn't have an answer, or she doesn't want to provide an answer. I mean, if they just, you know, if they just spent maybe half that much time and pay that much attention to the fact that kids are getting shot every day in the city of Chicago and that kids are getting killed.
Far more. COVID is a bigger, is less of a fear than getting gunned down on the streets of Chicago.
Yeah, I mean, for children, it's the crime pandemic. And let me point out, not only are the number it totally infuriates me when they say, you know, it's always been our policy that schools should stay open.
It's not. That's such a lie.
You backed down to the teachers union three times. You kept the schools closed for 15 consecutive months. Here's a stunning statistic for you. Arrest. The number of arrests for murder in the city of Chicago. I'm talking about school-aged children. For murder, 8% of the arrests, school-aged children. 9% of the arrests for shootings, 49% for the carjackings.
Yep.
You don't think the shutting down of schools and having these kids on the street? I mean, how many of these kids who left school or are about to leave school because schools have been, you know, literally the campus has been closed for this extended period, how many of them are going to turn to a life of criminality? I mean, it's been an absolute unmitigated disaster. But no, we're going to, you know, I mean, we're going to micromanage the system's reopening again. It's just outrageous.
So yesterday, the numbers went up from 0.5%. I'm sorry, 0.4% positivity rate to 1.5%. Positivity rate.
That's a 20% increase.
That's almost a quadruple.
Yeah. Oh, my God.
So the headline from the mainstream.
Oh, 1.5. Yeah, that's a quadruple. Sorry about that.
0.4 to 1.5.
Oh, 1.5.
And 1.5 is nothing, nothing, nothing compared to where we were at January at 10 0.7%.
Right. So the headline could say 400% increase in those infected. Almost 400%.
Exactly.
And it's crazy.
Or COVID cases have tripled in Chicago.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I called them out. Everybody in that room, I'm like, I don't want to hear that, oh, cases have tripled because we're not in a danger zone. But yet Mayor Lightfoot lets us know we are in the danger zone.
If we allow the virus to continue to linger here in Chicago, we will likely see further mutations, some of which our current vaccines may not be able to protect against, and have to reinforce some of the restrictions that have come to infamously define much of 2020 and part of 2021. The reality is this scenario, the worst case, is entirely preventable. And that's because we have three different vaccines readily available to all of our residents, which offer very good protection against Delta and other new variants.
So I want people to know that they're being played by this mayor. They are fearing, trying to put the fear of God into people so that they get vaccinated. And most, you know, our listeners are smart. They get it.
Right.
But 2 minutes after she said that, you know, and everyone's like, oh, we're going back to lockdowns. Oh, my God. Then Dr. Awardi says this.
Hospitalizations remain at the lowest they've been since the beginning of COVID. We have just 83 folks with COVID in the non-ICU and another 27 in the ICU. Single digit number of people on ventilators. Right. We are largely turning this into a preventable disease.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro. Answer line 64636. Type in DA, then a quick comment. I mean, it is, your head spins when you walk out of there, because I know what the mayor is trying to do. You know, they need to push this vaccination, especially we got Lollapalooza coming next week. And we'll get to that in a second. We're having people from all over the world come to Chicago.
They also need a diversion. You know, when you're having weekends, every weekend, 50, 60 people are getting shot. A dozen people are getting killed when you have children getting killed. I mean, they need a diversion. This is a diversion. We're in charge. We're making decisive decisions. Pretty soon we're probably going to see the mayor running commercials about how she steered this Chicago through this national pandemic.
And I was kind of being sarcastic when I said, asked the mayor this about Lollapalooza.
Do you regret, knowing that the positivity rate is on the rise, do you regret allowing Lollapalooza to happen next
sarcastic.
Week?
No, I think we made the best decision that we could, as always, based upon the data and based upon projections and modeling. We felt very comfortable on June 11th, which was the date, fully opening up the city. We had been kind of working towards that point, looking at trends. And
then Sarah Schulte from Channel 7 said, you know, if you had to decide today, would you have Lollapalooza next week? Yes or no? And she said, yeah, I'm going to have it. But she's having Lollapalooza because I had heard that if they weren't going to do Lollapalooza, Lollapalooza was going to go to an open and free state.
Yep.
They're not going to sit back and not make millions of dollars.
Those
owners aren't idiots.
Across the border to Indiana, where the economy is open. Incidentally, where schools have been open and they never shut down schools. And incidentally, a state that is giving its taxpayers I think it's a $560 million tax refund per capita compared to us. That would be the equivalent to Pritzker announcing a billion-dollar tax refund, because even before COVID, even before the COVID bailout coming from the federal government, I think the state's got like $23 billion in cash reserves.
Yeah.
That's because they didn't strangle their economy.
They have a surplus.
yeah, surplus. We don't have that. I don't even think we have any money in the rainy day fund. So, I mean, he did increase taxes close to $700 million this year. So please spare me. I mean, this is just another diversion. They're able to create the perception that they're taking decisive action, that they're in charge.
And then let's talk about the Delta variant. OK, so after all this, the mayor says doom and gloom.
Right.
Cases are spreading.
And
yes, they're more contagious, but they're not more lethal. Right. Dr. Awardi?
So as we continue to have more variants, the biggest concern about the Delta variant, as you said, it is very clearly more contagious, and not just a little bit more contagious. It's about 50% more contagious than the Alpha variant was, which itself is 50% more contagious than sort of the OG, the one originally from Wuhan. And what we therefore see is that the reason why Delta is on the increase here is because it is more contagious. So where there are no masks, no vaccines, no nothing, no anything, the original version of COVID somebody would transmit it on average to about two to three other people. The Delta variant, in the absence of vaccine, in the absence of masks, in the absence of any mitigation, would instead transmit to more like 3 to 4 people.
Oh, my God.
Right.
Hide your children, lock your windows and doors. And then I love, again, when Mayor Lightfoot plays Dr. Lightfoot. So cute.
For example, folks who only got one dose of Pfizer are only about 34% protected against the Delta variant, while folks who got both doses are 88% protected. That's a marked difference.
Okay, that's not what my doctor told me. So I actually, on the way home from the press conference, called my real doctor and said, hey, one shot of the Pfizer, how protective is it? He goes, it's better than the flu. It's equivalent to the Johnson & Johnson shot, one of the Johnson & Johnson. That's why in Europe, they're just giving one shot. And especially if you've had COVID before in Europe, not just the UK, but all the countries, if you've had COVID before, you are only getting and allowed one vaccine shot.
Hmm.
So, and they're not giving it to kids 12 and younger because they don't need to because they're not a health threat.
That's right.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 646-36. Type in DA, then a quick comment. Let's go to Marvin, who joins us in Burlington, Wisconsin.
Yes, it's really sort of fascinating to me why the government as a whole is so hell-bent on getting everybody vaccinated. Really makes you wonder what's in it. You know, I mean, did they really think that we're supposed to believe them when they say it's good for us? I mean, I look back at all the things that we're supposed to do from those people and that are good for us, and I'm sort of tells me to run from this thing as fast as I can. And if they really wanted to do something good for us, wouldn't the mayor be worried more about figuring out the crime problem in the city, trying to get people to come there and open up their businesses and getting kids back in quality schools, getting the teachers union under control, giving everybody a tax break? Maybe things like that you should worry about instead of everybody getting the vaccine. There's no way that I'm getting within 100 miles of that thing. Not in this lifetime.
Well,
no
what
way.
About talking to your doctor and just going up? Because that's what, I don't care what Pritzker says or Dr. Wardy. I mean, you know, she's a doctor and she does her homework. I get that. But you got to talk to your own physician, your own pediatrician. Have you done that, Marvin?
No, I don't go to the doctor. I run. The only time you need a doctor or a lawyer is when you're in trouble. I stay the hell away from
all right.
guys as much as
you're
I can.
You're such a dude, hey, such a guy.
Wait.
Yes, what?
If you just would teach kids common sense health practices in school, like maybe eat right, sleep right, take vitamins if you need to, you wouldn't have the problems that you do now. You know, get exercise. You do those things. And it's amazing how healthy you can stay.
All right. Thanks, Marvin. Appreciate the phone call. We got other calls. Real quickly, this is what President Biden said about the Delta variant. You know, Dr. Biden, not his wife, but Dr. Joe.
We can't let up, especially since and because of the Delta variant, which is more transmissible and more dangerous.
It's not more dangerous. He doesn't have his facts right.
I know.
All right, Eduardo in Midway, you are on Chicago's Morning Answer. Good morning.
Yeah, good morning, Amy and Paul. Everything's going to be fine. This is going to be more an effect on people who have conditions, you know, like my mother has high blood pressure and cholesterol. And social distancing is important, too, because India, you know, it's a very populated country.
Right.
It's reported that, you know, there were more cases than previously reported. And, Paul, speaking of this, we don't need another shutdown because WGN last night reported about IDS underreporting fraud. So we don't need any more shutdowns because you know what's going to happen if that happens.
Oh, I know. Yeah. People better join forces this time.
Absolutely.
And especially, I mean, let's just focus on the hospitalizations. Don't spread fear about cases. This is a virus. This is a cold and a flu. It is never going to be eradicated. So we have to learn how to live with it.
Yeah.
And masking kids up is the worst. It's detrimental to learning. I don't know if you've been in the classroom, but I'm trying to talk to them
terrible.
And see their faces and get to know their names, and you can't hear anybody. It's not working.
It's not normal, and our kids should not have to suffer. We're going to take a quick break, but when we come back, more of your phone calls. 312-642-5600.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Nice song. Oh, wait, this thing's on. Hi, 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. Let's go to Gary, who joins us in Streamwood. Good morning, Gary.
Good morning, Amy. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Doing great. You know, you were at the press conference when the doctor was talking about the hospitalizations for COVID. Uh-huh. It seems he could have been said that more people were hospitalized by projectile lead poisoning every weekend than their number of cases of COVID.
That's a good point. I mean, that's a very good point, because one weekend, we had 102 shot, mm-hmm. and you have 103 in the hospital.
Right.
And the 83 that are in the hospital right now, they're not in the hospital for COVID. They're in the hospital with COVID.
With COVID.
So they had other things that were happening and tested positive. Or sometimes if a woman goes to give birth and she tests positive, she's listed as a hospital, a COVID hospitalization. COVID. So it's ridiculous. All right, thanks, Gary.
Silly that you're welcome.
All right, thanks for pointing that out. Let's go to Dave in Racine. You are on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Yes. Hello, Amy, Paul. I was just thinking the situation no one takes into account is people who have natural immunity, for those who have had the COVID-19 virus. I mean, I've heard experts saying that they actually have a better immunity than those who've had the vaccine. So maybe if we had, people with haven't taken an immunity test could probably just as easily get all the benefits of those as those who've taken the vaccine.
That's a good point because, proof of prior infection, I think, should be just as good as a vaccination mm-hmm. card or, thanks, Dave, for the phone call. I tried to bring that up to Dr. Awardi yesterday, but we were only allowed two questions.
Well,
because to get into Lollapalooza, you have to have a negative test or a vaccine card.
So you have to bring your cards now. This is like
you have to on your phone. And then she warned people too. She's like, the FBI, you will. It is a felony if you falsify a vaccination card.
Yeah.
But the feds are going to be at Lollapalooza.
But you wish they were aggressive about people who are walking around with guns and don't have the license for the gun, so the FOI card.
But God forbid if you have
God
a fraudulent FOI vaccination card.
Yeah, somebody's going to be at the entries going, Pippis, please.
I can't wait because people are going to be, we're going to be watching that. We'll be. Are you going to Lollapalooza? What day are you going?
No, I've never gone to Lollapalooza. Never.
I went one time as a reporter. And I took vacation every year at the same time,
really?
So I never had to go back.
Yeah.
That's a juggernaut. I mean, and there's bodies everywhere. And, if they're taking whiskey naps or if they're overdosing.
When I worked in New Orleans after Katrina, where I ran the school district, part of the rebuild after Katrina, I was in New Orleans for 5 years. I never went to Mardi Gras.
Really?
Because it was, oh, my God. I mean, it's just
craziness.
It's craziness.
Does this mean, you know what we sound? We sound very old right now.
Yeah.
Connect with Dan and Amy using the AM560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile. Only the biggest stories, only the biggest guests, and only the biggest opinions. This is AM560, The Answer.
Rich men and their rockets. Who's your favorite billionaire, Paul Vallis? Wait, I think your microphone's not on.
Now it's
on. Okay.
Branson.
Richard Branson?
Yeah, I mean, his plane landed. He took the plane up, and then the plane landed like a normal plane. He didn't go up into the rocket, touch the sky, get like 5 seconds of zero gravity.
And then parachute back down.
I mean, if they wanted to do that, you know how they filmed those gravity scenes, those zero gravity scenes in like Apollo, the Tom Hanks movie, Apollo 13? Is they go up in this like big plane. And then the plane dives, and when the plane dives, it creates
The feeling of zero gravity.
So when you saw Tom Hanks like floating through the command module or whatever it was, they're actually in this big cargo plane and they're diving.
Okay.
So he could have done that. It's a lot cheaper if they wanted to do zero gravity.
Well, Jeff Bezos, you made history again, only though Richard Branson made it first.
Yeah, you beat your buddy.
Rich men and rockets.
And he's a poor billionaire.
He is. But you know what? He wants to thank you and thank us. Well, no, thank you.
You mean his minimum wage workers?
Jeff Bezos.
What you see is it's actually, I want to thank every Amazon employee and every Amazon customer, because you guys paid for all of this.
What a tone-deaf victory lap that he made yesterday.
We paid so that he could get a few seconds of zero gravity.
Yeah, well, one person, and, you know, he was being ridiculed on, you know, you guys paid for all this. I'd like a refund. People are tweeting out, I want my money back. I'm not going to use Amazon again. Okay, good luck.
Yeah, right.
But one person that he took up to space with him, or I don't even know if you consider it space, but Wally Funk, 82-year-old woman who got passed up because back then women could not be astronauts. But she finally got to get to the top.
And I want to thank you, sweetheart, because you made it possible for me. I've been waiting a long time to finally get it up there.
Oh, she got it up there, let me tell you. And while they were up there, they looked at the Earth's atmosphere.
What you see is it's actually incredibly thin. It's this tiny little fragile thing. Oh. And as we move about the planet, we're damaging it.
With more on that, now Jeff Bezos is going to be a climatologist.
Yes, he is.
All right, with more on this, and he has a new book. We welcome to the program Ryan Walters, independent historian, teacher at Collin College, and author of Apollo 1, The Tragedy That Put Us on the Moon. Good morning, Mr. Walters. How are you?
I'm doing great. How are y'all doing this morning?
Good. So did you watch Richard Branson, and did you watch Jeff Bezos' Blue Origin yesterday?
Now, of course, I did. I was insanely jealous, but yeah, I watched it. Pretty thrilling.
So, what are they trying to accomplish, though? Besides, you know, rich men and their rockets, is there a purpose to this?
I think they're that's one point. I mean, rich men and their rockets. I mean, it's a billionaire's space race is what we're going through. It's not like the '60s where it was between the United States and the Soviet Union. We've got billionaires now competing for space, but I mean, I think they're legitimately trying to build a space tourism industry, and I don't know how successful they'll be. I would certainly like to climb on one of those machines, but right now I think the ticket's pretty high. I think what some of the opening bids have been in the millions of dollars. I'm just a little bit short of that.
Yeah, me too. I'll spot you.
Yeah. Like all of it. I mean, I need like all of it. But
well, the youngest one day. The youngest kid on the Blue Origin was 18 years old, and his father, who's a billionaire in the Netherlands, paid $28 million for his son to go up in space to make history to be the youngest. Now, do you consider them really like going up into space? Did they deserve their wings?
The original astronauts would have said no. Of course, what they did yesterday, the Bezos mission was a suborbital. The first two missions we had in the early days of the Mercury program were just like that, suborbitals. They just went up and came back down because in those days we didn't have a rocket strong enough to put them in orbit, or at least one that didn't blow up a lot. and those guys, you know, in the early days, Alan Shepard, Gus Grissom, those guys trained relentlessly and did all that. And that kind of shows you where we are today. I mean, look how far we've come in terms of knowledge and technology. I guess that's one positive aspect to look at. None of these guys yesterday, I mean, Wally Funk was a pilot, but you know, Bezos had zero training. He didn't know what he was doing.
Yeah, all those.
So he went up and did essentially what Alan Shepard and Gus Grissom did in 1961 after years and years of training and tests and, you know, psychological evaluations and all those things.
Do you think hindsight being 2020, do you think they needed all that training just to basically go up there and come straight down?
Now, we know that now that they really didn't. Particularly the Mercury program. The Mercury program, our original program just to get a man in space, orbit the Earth, was extraordinarily primitive by today's standards. We look back on it just to do that. No, not really. But you got to remember, we didn't know anything about space or space travel. And they wanted, not only did they want military pilots, they had to be military test pilots.
That's right.
All of these qualifications. And then, of course, they went through all these crazy medical and psychological evaluations that were just ridiculous. But that just goes to show you the level of ignorance in those days. I don't mean that in an ugly way. I just mean we really just didn't know what we were doing. And these guys were, that's why they were test pilots. We were testing a lot of things, not just the spacecraft, but the spacesuits and everything. So they were really, truly pioneers. Today, you know, we don't, you don't really need any of that. I mean, Richard Branson, he didn't have any astronaut training.
No. Guys, but I'd much rather take that plane because it had a pilot flying it rather than Bezos yesterday. Who? I mean, how did that work? How did they get back into the atmosphere? They just deployed four parachutes?
Suborbital. Well, yeah, it just the capsule just detached and it parachuted back down. To get into orbit, you have to get it's not height, it's speed. You have to get 17,500 miles an hour to get into orbit.
Wow.
They didn't get to that speed, so they just went up and had a nice 10-minute view of the Earth and floated around and came back down and parachuted back down.
Do you still need the shields for reentry that you would need if you were in what's it referred to as a pulse orbital flight? I mean, do you still need the same reentry protection?
Oh yeah, I mean it's kind of if you noticed the capsule when it landed, it had some scorches on it. It's like the SpaceX capsule. I mean, it's going to, because you're in a very, at least I don't know exactly the altitude they were, I think only about 60 miles, but that's still, I think space is considered about 52 miles up. So you're coming back down in ever thickening air. It's getting thicker and thicker the closer you get to the ground. So that's what's causing the friction. So you have to have the heat shield or you're not going to last a few seconds.
Now Branson's vehicle was a reentry vehicle that landed. Did that have the type of reentry protection that the space shuttle had, you know, those tiles?
I'm sure it did. Yeah, right, the tiles. Yeah, yeah. I'm sure it had the same type tiles. So, yeah, and that's what people need to understand. And I hope we don't get the Titanic attitude with this, you know, that this is unsinkable. This is still dangerous. I mean, that rocket could blow up. If you have, talking about the tiles, one or two of those tiles get knocked off or fall off. That's what happened to Columbia.
Right.
Well, that's not what happened. It had a damaged wing. But if you lose some of those tiles in appropriate places, I mean, you can burn up. It's still a dangerous thing, and they got a lot of work to do, I think, before people are doing that as a matter of routine.
And Blue Origin, he'd sent up, 15 tests? They did 15 different tests on the rocket? And did they have any accidents? I remember one.
Yeah. You're always going to have that. I mean, you get that type of technology, that many moving parts. I mean, all it takes is one to fail, and you're going to have a problem. Of course, that is interesting that he tested it so many times. I mean, he's not like the old guys that, you know, tested it one or two times and then climbed up in it. Remember the first space shuttle in 1981, we didn't test it at all.
Oh, that's right. Oh, gosh.
We tested the components, but as far as putting it all together and flying it, there was no way to test it. We had to just put two guys in it, John Young and Bob Crippen, and say, okay, take off and let's see what happens.
Yeah. And Mr. Walters, let's quickly talk about your book, Apollo 1, The Tragedy That Put Us on the Moon. So the Apollo disaster occurred more than 50 years ago. Wow. And how is that tragedy still resonating today?
Well, the premise of my book is we would not have made it to the moon before Kennedy's deadline. It hadn't been for Apollo 1, the tragedy, because the Apollo program had gotten off the ground and we were trying to fly the first mission and the spacecraft just wasn't very good. There were a lot of mistakes and a lot of problems. The fire that killed the crew, Gus Grissom, Ed White, and Roger Chaffee, sort of exposed what was wrong with the program, and we were able to fix that and get back on the path to the moon. Of course, my position is I don't think we would have made the moon at all without the tragedy. There was a lot of public opposition to it. Most people don't realize that. Not everybody in the country was for Apollo, and by the time we got to the Apollo moon program, there was considerable opposition because of the level of money we were spending, which was about 5% of the federal budget at the time. If we'd had a disaster in space, for example, if there had been a fire explosion in space, lost a crew, I think that might have been enough to end the program. So it was a tragedy that had a silver lining to it.
Yeah, quick quick question, as a big movie fan, what is the best movie, the most authentic movie on the space program? You know, like First Man, Apollo 13, or The Right Stuff, in your opinion?
I'm not a big fan of The Right Stuff because of how they portrayed Gus Grissom in that particular. And I talk about that
right.
in the book. I'm actually in Mitchell, Indiana today at Gus Grissom's hometown. I'm doing a book signing there at an event here. And I just think he was treated pretty shabbily by Tom Wolfe's book and the movie. But I like Apollo 13. You were talking about the plane they put the set in, the famed Vomit Comet, they call it. That's what made that very authentic. I mean, if they had tried to do that on the ground and used different techniques, it probably would have been a disaster. And I do like First Man. Talking about the Apollo 1 fire, that's the best portrayal of the Apollo 1 fire is First Man.
Yeah. All right.
Very good.
All right. Thanks, Ryan Walters, independent historian, teacher at Collin College, author of Apollo 1, The Tragedy That Put Us on the Moon. Thank you so much for making time for us this morning.
Thank you so much. I enjoyed it.
All right. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
You've made the switch, and it feels so good. You switched to Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, and I love when doctors fight, especially during Senate committee hearings on the Capitol. Dr. Rand Paul questioning Dr. Fauci about the Wuhan lab and gain-of-function research that was going on at the Wuhan lab.
Dr. Fauci, knowing that it is a crime to lie to Congress, do you wish to retract your statement of May 11th where you claimed that the NIH never funded gain-of-function research in Wuhan?
Senator Paul, I have never lied before the Congress.
Microphone down.
Your microphone.
Senator Paul, I have never lied before the Congress, and I do not retract that statement. This paper that you are referring to was judged by qualified staff up and down the chain as not being gain of function.
You take an animal virus and you increase its transmissibility to humans, you're saying that's not gain of function?
Yeah, that is correct. And Senator Paul, you do not know what you are talking about, quite frankly.
Uh-oh,
and I want to say that officially. You do not know what you are talking about.
As the scientific research that increases the transmissibility among mammals is gain of function. They took animal viruses that only occur in animals, and they increased their transmissibility to humans. How you can say that is not gain of function?
It is not.
It's a dance, and you're dancing around this because you're trying to obscure responsibility for 4 million people dying around the world from a pandemic.
And let's send Dr. Fauci.
I have to. Well, now you're getting into something. If the point that you are making is that the grant that was funded as a subaward from EcoHealth to Wuhan created SARS-CoV-2. That's where you are getting. Let me finish.
We don't know.
Well,
we don't
wait
know
a minute.
If it did
I
come
can,
from the lab, but
you,
all the evidence is pointing that it came from the lab.
You,
and there will be responsibility for those who funded the lab, including yourself.
I totally
This committee
resent,
will allow the witness to respond.
I totally resent the lie that you are now propagating.
Yeah, who to believe? Dr. Rand Paul or Dr. Fauci? With more on this, let's welcome back to the program Paul Kangor, professor of political science at Grove City College in Grove City, Pennsylvania, contributor to the American Spectator and author of The Devil and Karl Marx, Communism's Long March of Death, Deception, and Infiltration. Good morning, Mr. Kangor. How are you?
Hi, Amy and Paul. That's great stuff.
Yeah. So who do you believe?
They both called one another liars.
Right.
They both. So, and thank you too, Amy, for at the start of that pointing out calling him Dr. Paul. Right.
Mm-hmm.
Rand Paul is a doctor and
an ophthalmologist.
And he's been. Yeah, and you know, also too, you know, not too far from you folks in Chicago, there's Senator Ron Johnson. And you know, Ron Johnson, another doctor, and he said last week that Anthony Fauci is not God, right? That which I think you have to tell that to some liberals, right? They seem to be confusing the two when it comes to medical omniscience here.
Well, have you ever seen a doctor whose face is on mugs, coffee mugs, pillows? There's Dr. Fauci Foxes. I mean, he's completely been idolized, and Dan Proft here calls him Saint Fauci.
Saint Anthony. There you go, right? Saint Anthony, us Catholics pray to when we've lost something.
And he was played by Brad Pitt.
That's true. I don't believe, because I'm Episcopalian. We don't we don't pray to saints. And my friend Lissa, I lost something. She said, "Well, just give it a try. Pray to Saint Anthony." And I did night. And the next morning, I found my stuff.
There you go.
So
there you go.
Crazy.
Now, if liberals are listening now, they're going to be paying to Saint Anthony Fauci, right, for whatever
exactly.
It is that's going on. And it's absolutely crazy. I mean, I wrote an article a few weeks ago, in fact, that led to the article that I published in American Spectator called From Herd Immunity to Herd Mentality. And I first sent the article to one of the regular publications that I write for, and the editor turned it down. We went back and forth and back and forth. And her final determination was, well, the CDC says that young people should get vaccinated anyway. And I said, well, so what if the CDC says that, right? I mean, we've got data here. You go to the CDC website right now. And by the way, I got to point out from the outset here, I'm not an anti-vaxxer, right? But there's information now that the CDC posts saying that they are troubled by reports of adolescents in particular getting myocarditis and pericarditis from the mRNA-based vaccines. So these would be the Pfizer and Moderna vaccines. And it says twice at the CDC website, we are monitoring this carefully. And then it says, but we still encourage these people to get vaccinated.
And there's even a warning label on the Pfizer vaccine.
That's right. It's never come off, saying that it's experimental. And in turn, I'm dealing with people who are mandating vaccines, and they're saying, well, the CDC says that. And I said, well, the CDC actually encourages young people. They're not saying that they must get vaccinated, but liberals are kind of taking this stuff, whatever the CDC says, whatever Fauci says, not just running with it, but you know, kind of treating it like holy writ, right? And you're running with it like it's the gospel truth. And the fact of the matter is that I would tell people listening right now, and I spent 4 years working in immunology at the University of Pittsburgh for the organ transplant team, late 1980s, early 1990s. If you're a young person in particular, be really, really, really careful about which of these vaccinations that you pick. I would advise people over 60, over 70 to get vaccinated. But a 15, 16-year-old girl, you got to think really carefully about this and do your homework, because some of these vaccines, and again, especially Pfizer and Moderna, these are not traditional vaccines. They use messenger RNA. There's a new one, hopefully, that will be approved soon called Novavax, which is a more traditional vaccine along the lines of, the shingles vaccine, hepatitis vaccine, the polio vaccine. That's more like the traditional heat-killed vaccine that people normally use. So be careful with this, because there's a girl in my area, 19 years old, who got myocarditis after a vaccine. She got a heart transplant, Amy, a few weeks ago. A heart transplant. Do you know what they do when they give you a heart transplant? They cut open right in the middle of your chest and pull your rib cage open and pull your heart out and put a new one in. I mean, you talk about something dramatic. I mean, that girl, she'll be lucky to live. And if she does live, it's not going to be easy.
I don't know. Right. But have they determined that her heart enlargement is because of the Pfizer vaccine?
Well, I'm trying to find this out, and I'm getting updates every other day about her. And I'll say for the record, that's what some are claiming. I can't say it for sure, but I can tell you that the CDC has taken this so seriously that twice now on their website they say flat out, we are monitoring these reports.
And you can find you can find that on the website, the CDC website, where it states that.
Yeah, they're monitoring. Yeah, it's on the website twice. In fact, It was on there three times. They removed one of them, and now there's just two. But they're very clear statements, and I commend the CDC for doing that. And they better do it, because some of these institutions that are mandating vaccines among young people, I'll tell you, these places, they better be careful. They're opening up themselves really wide for some serious lawsuit.
Well, we have a teachers union that has basically said that 80% of all eligible students must be vaccinated by October 1, and then they're demanding that 80% of the students under 12 be vaccinated within 60 days of a shot being approved for that age group. Think about that for a second.
But yet then that's they incredible. Won't have, but here real quick, Paul, but they won't have a vaccination mandate placed on them.
That's right. There's no vaccination mandate based on
They'll tell
on
us
them.
What to do with our kids, but we
right.
can't tell them.
Because
they're the ones that are in danger, not our kids.
Right, including the kids under
right.
the age of 12. And there have been only three children who have died.
In Chicago.
They claim COVID-related illnesses, but all three children had serious pre-existing conditions.
And they all died early in the pandemic.
Right.
Right, right. Well, that's exactly right. And I could tell you, in the case of my family, we had eight of us who got COVID. And of the eight, only two tested positive, because three of us got tested. I got tested. I had it first, and by that time, I knew I'd test negative because I'd kind of blown through it. It had been like 3 weeks. But in my family, that's eight. There's actually 10 of us, and I think the other two probably were asymptomatic. But I know for sure that eight of us had it. Only two of those show up on official records as COVID-positive cases. And this is an important point, because there are about 35 million registered cases of testing positive. But in reality, it's got to be at least triple that. Yeah. And I could tell you so many families like ours where they said, oh, yeah, we all had a loss of taste, loss of smell, temperature, coughing. None of us got tested because they're all little kids. It kind of blew through it in a couple days. And so this is important, because Fauci and the CDC and others are saying, well, we've got to reach like 75% vaccination because, you know, only X number of people have had COVID. No, it's not only X number of people. Everybody knows it's got to be more than 35 million.
And
it has to be.
Yeah, it has to be. And don't you think proof of infection should be just as good as a vaccination card?
Yes, precisely so. And that's what's really getting to me. And I just saw yesterday that the case at Indiana University in Bloomington, Bopp Law Firm, representing a number of students, Indiana University is forcing all these kids to be vaccinated, and they don't even have an exemption for kids who have already had COVID, of all things. And they don't even have a religious exemption in that case. So the idea that somebody who struggled and labored through COVID for 2 weeks, like my daughter, should be forced to now be vaccinated, they have natural immunity. They're part of herd immunity.
I know.
Right?
Natural immunity has taken the back seat in this.
Yeah. And I want to know, you know, why some mRNA-based vaccine that was researched 2 years ago by Pfizer is suddenly more effective against a brand-new Delta variant than natural immunity. Where's the proof of that? Right?
The FDA going to officially, you know, we're using it on an emergency basis right now. When are they going to actually come forward? You know, how long is it going to take for them to just, you know, just have non-emergency use and just say it is a viable vaccine?
Well, I don't think they can, Amy, because of these reports that are out there. Because of these reports of side effects, which is why they won't mess with it. I'm watching the Novavax very carefully. I'm reading reports that could be approved pretty soon. I think that one's probably safer. And I could tell you that a lot of the people that aren't vaccinated right now, I know many cases of this, are waiting for vaccines like that.
Okay.
And so they don't want to have to force their kid to get jabbed in the next few weeks before classes start, when there might be a better vaccine alternative, right? And that's common sense. And that's a kind of, you know, to quote the liberals, my body, my choice, right?
Right.
You know, keep your hands off my body. That's the kind of thing that they ought to honor, right? They're all for that when it comes to abortion, but when it comes to your own body, right? They want to put you in a line and shove the needle in you. It's outrageous.
All right, Paul Kengor, we have to leave it there for today, but thank you so much for joining us. We appreciate it. You can read his column, Herd Immunity to Herd Mentality and Had COVID, Not Getting Vaccinated, at spectator.org. Thanks, Paul.
All right. Take care, you guys.
You too. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Hear about the big stories of the day, then talk about them right here on Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
All right. The Tampa Bay Buccaneers went to the White House yesterday, and Tom Brady, he waded into political waters a little bit, popping off a couple of jokes. He was actually, I found him kind of cute, but he's really good friends, and he's not ashamed of it. He's very good friends with President Trump. And he seemed very chummy with Biden. So yeah. I was like, what is going on here? Here, listen and you decide.
Group of men. It didn't look great there at one point. We were 7-5, struggling a little bit, as the president alluded to. But we found our rhythm. We got on a roll. Not a lot of people, you know, think that we could have won. And in fact, I think about 40% of the people still don't think we won.
You understand that,
Mr. President?
I understand that.
Yeah.
That's funny.
And personally, you know, it's nice for me to be back here. We had a game in Chicago where I forgot what down it was.
Thank God.
I lost track of one down in 21 years of playing. And they started calling me Sleepy Tom. Why would they do that to me?
I mean, he's really...
I thought that was cute. A little joke on the left, a little joke on the right, or right or left.
But I remember that game. Like, what's going on with Tom Brady?
I know.
He has no idea what down it
was.
Yeah, and then they were 7-5, and they came back and had a successful
Amazing.
Season. But I'll tell you, that is one thing that helped me get through the pandemic. The Bucks were still playing, and my youngest is a huge Tampa Bay fan. So I probably spent a little more money than I should have, but that's what he got for his birthday was the experience. We went to that game, and it was against the Vikings, and the Minnesota fans, the like grown big men with big beer guts, they were crying because they were watching Life of... It's like Stockholm Syndrome, and people were like, oh, this is... Was this football? And everyone, you know, it was social distancing, and you had to wear a mask, but it was a surreal feeling, and people... We're thanking, you know, they're thanking us because they thought we were from Florida because we're Tampa Bay. So like, thank you for having us. And your state is so wonderful and your governor is so wonderful. And this is the best I've felt in a year. And so, and Santos did it right.
Yeah.
And we could have had football.
We could have had football.
And the McCaskies wanted football. And I think that's one of the reasons probably why they're moving out, because Lori Lightfoot would not let. And she teased around and she teased with us a little bit, like, you know, acting real tough. Like, you know, I may have fans at football games. I don't want to say something too early, and she never had that.
Oh, yeah.
But I think we're full steam ahead for next season with the Bears.
Let's keep our fingers crossed. But, you know, and I hate to keep on harping on this. We could have had school all year last year, too. And
we could have had school.
And we could have had school.
And Mike announced earlier that the Catholic Archdiocese has said if you're vaccinated...
You don't have to wear a mask.
Don't have to wear a mask.
If you want to encourage people to vaccinate...
The Catholics are going to lead the way just like they did last year.
But, you know, the irony of all that is in the Biden education bill, in the 100 and what was it, $32 billion that was allocated, less than 3% of that money is going to parochial and private schools.
Isn't that illegal?
During the previous administration, I think about 10% of the funding did. So these are the schools that opened. These are the schools that are educating taxpayers' children. These are the schools that are educating, at least in Chicago, large percentage of the kids are poor kids. You know, the Archdiocese, they have a scholarship program for these kids. And they're getting pennies on the dollar. They're getting pennies
on
the dollar.
Biden.
And they
isn't
were
Biden
open.
Catholic?
That's right. He went to a Catholic school. He brags about how Catholic education really made him the person he is today. And they're getting totally, totally shortchanged. And it's a pity.
There's only one radio show in Chicago talking about today's biggest stories and telling you what they really mean. That show is this one. Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560, The Answer.
Oh, you know what that song means. New Trier's bad boy, Stephen Moore, is on the turnkey.pro answer line. Good morning, Mr. Moore. How are you?
Hi, Amy. Good morning.
Good morning.
What is this? You know, we're in the middle of a financial crisis, and Dan is out playing golf. Does he care about our country?
No, he doesn't. Freedom never sleeps, I once heard. But I wanted to talk to you about this real quick, because there's a new wave of workers who are calling it quits, you know, because why work when you can stay home and make more than you want? Here's Ashley. She worked at Burger King, don't you know, and I think it was in Tennessee, and she and everybody quit, and they put a sign on the marquee saying, we're not open because we're quitting. We don't like our boss.
I couldn't do it. I could not work for somebody that treats their employees that way any longer. I immediately found another job after I quit.
Because there's so many jobs out there. Now let me introduce you to Natalie. Natalie doesn't want to go back to work. Natalie likes working from home.
The pandemic happened. I had a lot of free time to think what I truly valued as a human being. And that all came down to my own personal freedom. And I love working remotely.
And it's sad, Stephen, because as you probably know, most of the high rises, the office buildings in downtown Chicago are still empty because nobody's requiring their workers to go back to work until after Labor Day in September.
Yeah, so look, this is in part of a result of the $300 a week unemployment extra benefits, which, by the way, Illinois is still paying those benefits. It's absolutely crazy. There are 26 states that have stopped paying the supplemental unemployment benefits. And guess which states had the biggest decline in unemployment last month?
The ones that stopped the supplemental unemployment.
That's right.
Isn't it funny how that stuff works? I mean, if economics is really pretty simple, guys. I mean, if you subsidize something, unemployment, you get more of it. And if you tax something, work, you get less of it. And that's what we're doing right now. It is absolutely absurd that there are still 24 states that are paying these extra unemployment benefits. In Illinois, a couple with two kids, because of it, by the way, it's not just unemployment benefits. It's food stamps, it's free health care, it's nutrition assistance, it is rental assistance, all of these programs. If you live in Illinois and you got two unemployed parents and two kids, they can make the equivalent of $100,000 a year for not working a single hour. That is craziness. Look, I believe in a safety net, but that's a hammock, folks, and it's not fair to the people who are working. Now, here's something you may not have heard, guys. There is now legislation in Congress. Honest to God truth, I am not making this up. The Democrats want to make the $300 a week unemployment benefits permanent. Permanent.
So universal basic income, pretty much.
Yeah, that's where they're headed.
Exactly.
Well, this is the thing. All right, so this child tax credit, I noticed I got a little bump in my check, in my banking account. Well, but here's the thing. Nancy Pelosi, it's supposed to stop in December, but Nancy Pelosi wants to keep this gravy train going on forever.
We are going to fight to make sure that this is permanent. But again, the strongest weapon in that fight is that it works and that people truly avail themselves of it and not stay home from work because they have this advantage, but in fact see themselves freed up to go to work.
Hey, Stephen Moore, I have a neighbor who has three kids, six and under. She's getting $900 a month.
Wow.
And it might be till infinity and beyond. I mean, if the Democrats have their way, and that's basically universal basic income.
Well, by the way, don't forget, so she's getting $900 a month. I don't know her exact situation, but let's say she is unemployed. Let's say she's getting unemployment benefits. So she's getting also about $400 a month in unemployment benefits. I mean, $400 a week in unemployment benefits. Plus the extra $300 a week unemployment. I mean, that's a pretty high amount of money. You're talking about, you know, as much as, you know, $6,000-$7,000 a month in all of these benefits. Now, here's the thing. I love what Nancy Pelosi just said in that clip. She said, people make avail themselves to this money. What they're doing is, look, there's no free money, folks. The only way that someone who's getting these checks can avail themselves to it is by taking money away from me. Right? So this is just a game of kabuki. Who pays for it and who doesn't? The problem is the people who are the hardworking people, the people who are working, the truckers, the people who are working in the nursing homes, the people who are, you know, working the delivery people, the people who are working in the grocery stores, they're getting screwed by this because they're working hard and the guy next door is getting more money than they are and they're sitting on the couch watching Netflix. I mean, somebody explain the economics of that.
I did just add it up. So my neighbor's making $2,100 a month. She's taking me out to lunch.
$2,100 a month.
Think about that.
Working a single hour.
Because she's unemployed. This is
the amazing thing that anybody is working, you know, given how much we're paying people not to. And I really do worry about the future of our country. More and more people are becoming and feeling like they're entitled to other people's money, and that is the path to economic ruin.
Yeah, look, I agree 100%. I mean, the priority within the Democratic Party right now, Congress, is to make these benefits permanent and to really move towards universal basic income.
Right.
That's been the strategy. That's how they're going to do it. They're going to buy people off, essentially. And I'll tell you, you know, having grown up in the restaurant business and obviously knowing a lot of restaurateurs and people in the service sector, I mean, they are having a horrible time finding people to work. An absolute horrible time finding people to work because you can stay at home and you can make much more money than you ever made working at the local restaurant.
I'm still trying to wrap my head around my neighbor's wealth. But because, no, think about it. She lived, because her family's in Alabama, she lived in rural Alabama, $2,100 a month or even $1,500 a month. Yeah, you don't have to work ever in your life.
Yeah, well, look, the question I've been pondering, I get asked this all the time, I wonder what you guys think. Is this deliberate? Are the Democrats trying to make more and more and more Americans just dependent on government? By the way, the other thing that's going on as we speak is the Democrats have a new plan to expand Medicare. They want to provide Medicaid in states that didn't take the Obamacare subsidies. They're going to give free Obamacare subsidies to people in those states. I mean, everybody's become this massive entitlement state. Everybody is going to be dependent on government. And the question is this deliberate? Is this what the Democrats want? And I used to say no, but now I'm not so sure.
And what about with all the inflation? I mean, Biden said, oh, this is just temporary, you know, the higher cost of groceries and gas. I don't see this being temporary. And where's the exit ramp to this?
Yeah, I think the word now is transitory. That's the new in vogue word, transitory. It's just here for a little while, except that when Biden spoke, he made two errors in his thinking. Number one, he said, we're getting control of inflation. No, they're not. The inflation is getting worse. It's not getting better. I mean, anybody who ever pumps a gallon of gasoline or goes to a grocery store understands that. It's getting worse. It's not getting better. Number two, he said, we're adopting policies that are going to try to stop this inflation. No, they're not. They are proposing $4.5 trillion more spending in this so-called reconciliation bill. Four followed by 12 zeros of spending. That's more money than we spent on World War II. That's how much they want to spend. Now, if you spend and borrow and print that much money, okay, here's your economic lesson for today. Are you ready? What happens to inflation if you print $4 trillion of money?
A loaf of bread's going to be $35.
Exactly. I mean, all this free money just means the prices go up and up. I don't know if people know the famous story of what happened to Germany in World War I, where basically they so massively spent with deficit spending that people used to have to, the peasants used to have to take wheelbarrows full of German marks to the grocery store so they could pay their bills. And incidentally, I want to ask you guys about, you said you were in the restaurant business. The problem is those restaurants have very small profit margins, right?
Very small.
So if you increase the Democrats, they're just going to have to pay their workers more. Well, how are they going to do that? You're going to put these small businesses out of business. Isn't that true?
Well, I remember during the Carter years when inflation was 10, 11, 12%. I mean,
mortgages were 18.5%.
We barely survived. We had two restaurants. We barely survived. The margins are so small. You know, and we had the whole family working in the restaurant too, just to kind of control our labor costs. My mom used to joke that my dad wanted to spend more time with the kids, so we opened the restaurant.
Hey-o.
So we all worked in the restaurant.
But you're going to actually see a lot more of that. Actually.
Yes,
you see that especially with like Korean and Chinese restaurants. You know, you get the 13-year-old kid behind the cash register, and that's the only way they're going to be able to survive. And I doubt that they're paying their 14-year-old the $15 an hour.
No, they're just happy to work and spend time with the family.
You know, it's not like we could run out and adjust the menu with regularity. I mean,
that's a great point.
I mean, we just barely survived. But you're so right. I mean, even a moderate increase in inflation is going to have a devastating impact on the service industry.
And I just wanted to introduce you, Stephen. I want you to hear, this is a restaurant owner in Southern California who's having a hard time, even when he's offering more money, getting anybody to apply.
Given the demand for employees, we've increased our average kitchen hourly rate by as much as 20 to 40% in order to keep the staff that we have and draw in new people. We had staff leave because they found as much as $18, $20 an hour elsewhere. And we are a single business, so we don't exactly have the freedom to do that.
And there was one restaurant in New York, though, saying, apply for the job, stay for a year, and we'll give you an all-inclusive week for free in Costa Rica.
Well, you know, truckers now in Texas, they're offering $10,000 a month salary for truckers. And we have a shortage of about 60,000 to 75,000 truckers across the country. It's another reason why prices are rising. In a lot of areas, you literally can't get the gasoline from the wells to the pumps because the truckers aren't there to deliver it because so many people. And by the way, being a trucker, that's a tough job. If you can make, you know, $40,000, $50,000, $60,000 a year for just sitting on the couch, a lot of people are going to choose that. Look, we got to get back to normal. Stop spending money. We're reopening our businesses. One last thing. I know we're running out of time. The people, you know, Joe Biden says, oh, that's okay. These businesses can just pay their workers more. That works if you're Amazon or if you're Walmart or you're, you know, Home Depot, where you've got, you know, big profit margins. But the little guys get screwed. And I would submit to you, everything we've done during the COVID era screws the little guys. They're the ones that weren't allowed to open up their doors.
You're right.
Walmart and Walgreens and Amazon were open. And we're not going to have any small businesses left in this country.
I know. Did you hear that, too? We might have more lockdowns here. Because we went from 0.4 to 1.5% positivity rate. That's nothing.
Yeah, I mean, this is ridiculous. Anyone in the state of Illinois or anywhere in the country, if you want to get vaccinated, you can get vaccinated. There is no reason for lockdowns. And vaccinated people are 99%, you know, vaccinated, and they don't get COVID. So I don't understand all the lockdowns. You know, they also, Amy, I'm pissed off that they want to now, in many states, they want to require kids for 6 hours in school to wear masks.
Oh, I know. We're waiting for, well, the IDPH, Illinois Department of Public Health, should be coming out before week's end with their new guidance. And I am just, I mean, that was, you know, the carrot at the end of the stick was get your kids vaccinated and they could be mask free. I mean, I went to football practice watching both of my boys play, and kids were puking because they're making them wear masks out in the heat, pads on, helmet. I mean, it's ridiculous. And they're all vaccinated.
You know what's even worse? Is that, look, I am pro-vax. For anybody over the age of 30, even 25, should be vaccinated. But if you have 6 and 8-year-olds vaccinated, I think it's more dangerous for their health to be vaccinated than not.
Yep.
It's ridiculous. And by the way, the chance of your kid dying from COVID is like less than the chance of crossing the street and dying.
Well, the mortality rate is much higher for the flu, and that has been proven. It's 0.0002 mortality rate for COVID.
So then, Amy, why do the kids have to wear masks and why do they have to be vaccinated? I mean, look, I'm not anti-vaccination. I'm in favor of vaccination.
Me too.
But for people who are vulnerable, and that's not a 7-year-old.
I know. And I told Paul this during the break. There's kids who are playing in sprinklers with their bathing suits on,
with their masks on,
that are soaking wet. Stephen Moore, it's so ridiculous. I should send you pictures, but then they're minors and I look like a creep. So I'm not going to tweet that out. All right, Stephen Moore, we're going to have to leave it there for today, but always a pleasure having you on, and we love you. You're the best.
Take care.
All right, bye. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
It's news, opinion, insight. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer.
Good Wednesday morning. Amy Jacobson here. Paul Vallis in for Dan Proft. Always a pleasure. Thank you for coming in.
My pleasure.
I see you found your way this morning to the station, standing outside the door waiting to be let in.
That's right.
But we always have a busy, busy news day when you're here, so I really appreciate you coming in. Last year, remember last August at this time, we just recovered from the George Floyd riots all over the country, and then we had the incident, the police shooting in Kenosha, Wisconsin,
with Jacob Blake, and it sparked a lot of violence all over again, especially particularly in the town of Kenosha, Wisconsin, where that town was absolutely destroyed. And I went there a few months ago, and there's buildings that are still boarded up and businesses that are still boarded up from what happened. So with more on this and other things and talking about a new book, we want to welcome to the program James E. Ward Jr. He is pastor and founder of Insight Church in Skokie and author of Zero Victim, Overcoming Injustice with a New Attitude. Good morning, Mr. Ward. How are you?
Hey, Amy. I'm doing fantastic. And thank you so much for having me on, and welcome to Paul. Really an honor to be with you. Thank you.
Thank you. So tell us, because you are Jacob Blake's mother's pastor, correct?
That's correct. Yep. Julia Jackson has been a member of our church since the very beginning, and her mother as well, Janie Johnson. And now Jacob is an amazing family. And I really wish and look forward to the time when the nation will get the opportunity to really know the real Julia and Jacob Blake Jr. They're amazing people.
Well, tell us about Jacob Blake Jr., because was how the media portrayed him accurate? I mean, they said that, you know, he was there because, well, just tell us your version of what happened.
Yeah, the circumstances, you know, are what they are, and I can't speak into the incident of itself, but I can speak to Jacob's character and what I've come to know him and what I know about he and his mother and his grandmother. He's an amazing father. You know, he's part of our church. He's involved in prayer meetings in our church. And I look forward to the time when he'll have the opportunity to communicate his story. We're thankful that he's alive, you know, which is not something that you would expect in a situation like this. But at some point, the nation is going to hear from Jacob, and I'll let Jacob tell Jacob's story. But I can say as his pastor, he's an amazing young man, and we're so proud of him.
Well, I'm glad that he's found God. Did he find God after this incident happened, or was he a parishioner before?
He grew up. His family is all, he and his mother and his grandmother have always been connected to the church. His grandmother was part of my father-in-law's church, as a matter of fact. And so you grow up in and around the things of God, but like so many of us, I think you stray away from those. But I would say certainly that since that time, he's grown much, much stronger in his faith. And it's just an amazing story of the redemptive power of Christ, which is something that we all need and live by. And so he'll have a tremendous story that's an encouragement to all of us, I think, of the power of God through his grace and his mercy to save and to rebuild and bring restoration to our lives.
You know, Reverend Ward, you talk about rejecting victim mentality and ideologies like critical race theory. You know, I've made an observation being a longtime superintendent that my fear with the critical race theory is what it will do to separate or to create friction between children and their parents. For example, I know a gifted teacher, remain unnamed, and she tells her white students that despite challenges that they may face, they still are privileged. And of course, you know, and there's generational responsibility for racism. And then she tells the black children in her class that for all practical purposes, they're victims or they're the victims of historical racism. And my fear is what that does when the kids go home. You know, the white and the white kids have to be guided by their parents who have bare responsibility for institutional racism. But the black kids have to face their parents who have allowed themselves to be exploited. And I don't know. Can you give me your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think you mentioned a key word, Paul, which is separation. You know, I tell folks, and certainly being a pastor, speaking into these issues from a spiritual and moral perspective, you know, Amy and Paul, we have a sin problem in our nation and not a skin problem. And the problem with critical race theory is that it is a theory. Theory is based upon man's idea. I say we need critical race theology and not create critical race theory. Theology is God's idea about circumstances. Theory is man's idea. And so my challenge with critical race theory is that it's based upon a human perspective. It's based upon punitive and not redemptive at all in nation. And victim mentality, victim thinking is the soil from which critical race theory grows. When we think of zero victim mentality, That is the mind of Christ himself. And so I'd like to say in our nation right now, we need critical race theology, not critical race theory that is based upon man's ideas and something that's being weaponized and politicized to bring division when God always unifies. We have to continue to be one nation under God. Whenever you remove God from society, human consciousness goes with it. The human conscience goes with it. We have a deficit spiritually and morally, a breakdown of spiritual and moral law in our nation, which allows these ideas like critical race theory that may have an element of truth to them, but those things become perverted and corrupt when you take faith and you take truth out of the perspective. And so we got to get our nation brought back to being one nation under God. And that's what we're here to do, to keep that righteous and that godly influence in society.
Then, Pastor Ward, what's your thinking on Black Lives Matter and on President Trump?
Sure. So it's very, very simple. I tell folks, I get that question a lot, Amy. For me, Black Lives Matter because I'm black, my wife is black, my children are black. Of course we matter. We matter to God. So for me, that is not a question. It's never been a question in terms of my value and my identity. And so the concept, we have to separate the idea from the organization. And so the idea matters because we're human and we matter. But the organization, in terms of what it represents, in terms of its values and its objectives and the things that it seeks to accomplish, is not something that we subscribe to and endorse because it does not line up with our Christian faith. And so I like to make the distinction between there. I think that Black Lives Matter overall is a cry of pain when people are hurting. I think that Black Americans, when we're hurting, there's a cry for pain. But the way that we're going about it to bring resolution to those issues is not God's way. And when you mention President Trump, personally, on a personal basis, having the opportunity to have had conversation with him multiple times on the phone and work with his staff, I don't have any problems, you know, with him. I'm here to serve. I don't have any problems with President Biden. I'm here to serve whoever the sitting president is. So I find myself in a position that we tell folks that we're not on the right or the left. We're here to call folks on the right and the left above back into the kingdom of God. I think we made the mistake of allowing folks to think that it's about right versus left instead of right versus wrong. And so we got to come back to a place of really seeing our nation built upon the truth of God's word, which will benefit every citizen. And I was thankful for the time that we had to interact with President Trump.
All right. And that your book is called Zero Victim. Why did you decide to write it?
I wrote it because of, you know, Amy, this is something that is how I live my life. You know, I grew up in Tuscaloosa, Alabama, at the very end of the segregation of the school system. And in a short version of the story, when I realized that my performance and my ability to do well had nothing to do with the environment around me, going to the white side of town in third grade, when I realized that I was intelligent and I was smart and I could perform well, I realized that the white kids around me were not against me. And it freed something on the inside of me. It liberated me from the mentality of defeat. And from that point, it changed the trajectory of my life, that my relationships have always been high-quality relationships. We're intended to live life from the inside out, not from the outside in. Mm. And we can't control what we go through, but we can control how we go through it. And so there has to be a shift in victim thinking, which is inundated our society right now. And I'll give you the short version of how Zero Victim is connected to our faith. You think about Jesus Christ. He's the only innocent man that ever lived on the planet, and he suffered the greatest injustice that the world has ever known, of being crucified. But while being crucified and the nails are still being driven in his hand, Amy and Paul, he's already praying, Father, forgive them, because they don't know what they're doing. Okay. That is the standard of how we deal for injustice. And every other injustice is a lesser injustice. And so grace and the mercy of God, the capacity to forgive, has been given to us through faith. I tell our church folks even, you know, I love the grand wizard of the case, whoever the guy is, because I am not a victim, and the love of God in me is greater than the hatred in him. If we can get that mindset reintroduced to our nation, there's no injustice, there's no problem that we can't overcome. We got to call our nation back to faith in God, and we're here to do that. I really want to encourage your listeners to go to zerovictim.com. Please get a copy of the book. I think this is something that our nation needs right now, and we're grateful for your help in getting the word out.
All right. Thank you so much, Pastor.
Again, thank you.
Zerovictim.com is where you can pre-order your book. Thanks so much, Pastor Ward. We appreciate it.
My pleasure, and thank you. Hope to be with you again. All the best.
Thank you. You too. And he joined us on our Turnkey AM560.ProAnswerLine.
Listen to podcasts of Dan and Amy from the AM560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile.
312-642-5600 is our turnkey.proanswerline. 64636. Type in DA. Then a quick comment. We're talking about critical race theory, and there's a teacher in Evanston, and we've told you about her before. Her name is Stacy DeMar. She's a white drama teacher at Nichols Middle School, and she's suing the district for their anti-racism education plan, otherwise known as CRT. And she's filed a discrimination lawsuit against her school that has mandated anti-racist training, and she believes it has created a hostile environment for white students and educators. All right, so this is what, so she had to take these seminars, Paul, and it requires teacher to accept that white people are authoritarian and controlling, and it also teaches teachers, quote, to be less white is to be less aggressive. She's asking for $1 in damages, and she wants attorney fees paid. And yesterday, parents and the mayor of Evanston, they held a rally denouncing her, and leading the charge is their brand newly minted mayor, Dan Bliss.
I'm so blessed that my children benefit from that education every single year.
I mean, he's so smug. I mean, what, didn't he run for governor? He's a perennial candidate, isn't he?
Yeah, I mean, isn't this the district that's kind of like a, they're concerned that with too many accelerated and advanced placement and honors courses, that somehow that's like discriminatory, or it's going to make, you know, minority students self-conscious. So they're kind of beginning to drift away from standards. And is that the same district that, if you remember, the superintendent originally was only going to allow the black kids to come back and to do
in-person learning.
In-person learning, obviously, because they're disadvantaged as opposed to the white kids. I mean, give me a freaking break here.
Oh, but all the parents piled on this poor Stacy Deemer.
Since when is truth anti-white?
We shutting down the production of white victimhood in this community.
Oh, my God.
There's a lot of hard questions around the history of this country, and I think our district does an amazing job of teaching it at the right age level.
312-642-5600, turnkey.proanswerline, 64636, type in DA, then a quick comment. I think that CTR, critical race theory, CRT, excuse me, just teaches people to hate one another. Look, and it's very anti-American.
Look, you know, this is not about making sure that you're teaching history accurately. You know, I'll hearken back to my tenure at the Chicago Public Schools, where we revamped our history curriculum. We taught African-American history year-round. It wasn't like, oh, this is African-American
History
Month.
It wasn't just February, African History Month.
We incorporated African history into world history, et cetera. But this goes beyond it. You know, I've stressed three concerns about this preoccupation with critical race theory. One is the time it is taken away from core instructional areas. Because it's not like the unions are giving us more instructional time so we can spend providing this type of instruction. Second is the degree to which the state is lowering its standards. Right now, it's my understanding that Pritzker signed a law that basically now the teachers don't have to be tested for content area mastery, but there are the critical race or the new mandates regarding the new curriculum standards that they have to meet, like the critical race theory curriculum standards. And the third thing is the degree to which this curriculum is going to create friction within the households. You know, if I'm a white child and I'm being told that I've got to read a book about a cop who basically shoots a black kid, and I'm the daughter of a police officer, you know what I mean? Or if I'm constantly being told as a white student that my parents and grandparents are responsible for institutional racism. How do I go?
It's just suggesting that this country was built on slavery.
And how do I take advice from my parents when I come home, when my mother or father tells me to shut off the TV or to stop playing on, you know, stop texting on, you know, on your cell phone and things like that? Or if I'm a black student and I'm constantly being told that I'm a victim and not being told that I have the capacity to overcome anything. I mean, what's the attitude of that child when that child goes home and that child has to interact with his or her parents, parents who have allowed themselves to be victimized? I mean, it really creates a division within the families. It divides the races, and it creates divisions within the families.
And then eventually your neighborhood, and then eventually your country.
Yeah, it's just...
Connect with Dan and Amy on the AM 560 The Answer mobile app. Just text the word app to 64636 to download the app today. Only the biggest guests and only the biggest opinions. This is AM 560 The Answer.
All right. Welcome back. AM 560 The Answer. Amy Jacobson here. Paul Vallis in for Dan Prof today. I haven't figured out. Oh, I think, you know what? Dan's golfing bobolinks today, and that's that men-only golf course.
Oh, men-only.
So I told him I was going to transition into Tom and stop by and say hi to him and his foursome. So thanks for filling in today. All right. We have another novelist, the author extraordinaire. You know, the number one New York Times best-selling author, most recently of Near Dark, which is now on sale. And without further ado, we welcome back Brad Thor to our program. Good morning, Brad. How are you?
Good morning. It's my annual checkup. Anybody get shot in Chicago since I moved to Nashville?
Yeah, well, you know, what was it last weekend? It's so awful that it was a 56 shot, no, 59 shot and 10 dead. 11 dead, I'm sorry. Yeah, it's awful. I mean, what are you guys all making of Chicago?
Did you just say the A word? That's racist. If Lori Lightfoot hears you call that awful, she's going to get you, Amy. You better be careful.
I know. No, I was there, too, and I said, what do you want me to do? I'm white. I work so hard to get to this city as a reporter because I'm from here, and I moved to seven different states
right.
And worked at ABC, Fox, CBS, NBC, blah, 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 blah. And she said, well, it's not your problem, Amy. It's your boss's problem. Like, oh, then I'll just resign.
Okay.
I mean, she's out of her mind. But what do you guys all make of Chicago?
Well, you know, the first thing that happens when I moved down to Nashville is everybody's like, okay, you can move here. Just don't start voting funny. Don't bring any of the Chicago-style stuff down here. You know, Nashville's a great, great town, but we've got a crazy mayor that because of COVID and we get so much of our income from tourism, with COVID shutting stuff down, he pushed through a 37% property tax increase. So that's
very Illinois-esque, Brad.
Yep, everything funded with bonds and all that kind of stuff, and they're having trouble with their budgets. And so, yeah, so it's catching up. You know, that's what happens when you live in a liberal city, unfortunately, that's, you know, run by a liberal mayor. They're not fiscally responsible, unfortunately. But it's still better than Chicago. I'm still paying less money, and nobody's shooting at me. My kids are in good schools.
Yeah, they're safer. I know I stayed up last night. I was telling Paul here, because my son was out past 10. Like, you need to get home. Because gangbangers don't care. It's dark outside. It's not safe. So it's not a good situation for a lot of people. But is there any... Back to your mayor, though. When is he up for re-election?
Let's see. No. I think it's coming up. I think it's next year. So we'll have to...
is he going to have a Republican challenger?
I'd like to see it happen. You know, and this guy was, he comes from a financial background, and he was kind of head of the budget committee here, and he was going to get everything, you know, pulled together. And it was just, you know, politicians lie, Amy. We're going to break some news today. How about that, Paul? Politicians lie.
This Justin.
How about your schools? I mean, how did they handle the last school year? Were the schools...
Well, did they have in-person learning?
Yeah, I mean, were they exclusive in-person learning, or did they have a hybrid model?
So they had hybrids, they did cohorts, they were doing a lot of stuff. They were very successful down here. So they really wanted the kids in classrooms.
Very good.
So that was good with where my kids were in school. So that was excellent. It's tough when the kids did have to remote because the teachers just weren't, you know, very skilled with it. But they worked hard to get it done. So we like that, and we're looking forward to being back in school in the fall.
And are you guys going to be masked in the fall, or is that to be decided, excuse me.
TBD. So here's my thing. We got vaccinated right away because my wife's a doctor and she came out of a medical research background, and we believe the vaccines are safe and effective, and we've got an immunocompromised person in the family. So we didn't want to catch COVID. We didn't want to give COVID to this person. And the thing that's interesting is there was a study about 3 weeks ago from this biobank. The UK puts all, because it's a national health system, it pools all of its health records. And they thought, boy, it's really interesting. People are losing taste and smell. We've got all these people in our system. Let's look at brain scans of folks before COVID hit. Then let's identify people who had COVID and rescan them. And what they found in rescanning them over in the UK was that there was brain damage in all of them. It's interesting. So they're now launching a big study in the UK to say, if you get COVID, does everybody get brain damage? Because that's what we saw in this 400-person test we did. So
wow.
Now COVID is at the point where if you're vaccinated or if you've caught it, already and you have natural immunity, it's not supposed to be a big deal if you get it. But if there's brain damage or long-term brain fog, as a novelist, I don't want that. So I'm going to do everything I can not to catch COVID, even though I'm vaccinated. I don't wear a mask to virtue signal or anything, mm-hmm. but I am, I'm trying to not get it because it would kill my career if I got sloppy in the head.
See, I had severe brain fog after I got the vaccine.
Really? Wow.
Oh, I felt nauseous. I mean, it took 2 weeks for me to come out of it, and I did, but... And I never had COVID, but I got vaccinated. I got my kids vaccinated because I think I talked to my doctor. I didn't listen to my governor. And my doctor said, do it.
Well, I got COVID, and so did my boys. And I actually became more prolific. My pulse got longer. Somebody called me. Somebody referred to me as the Leo Tolstoy of Facebook. But I did lose, and he wasn't being complimentary.
Yeah.
But I lost my taste, but then my wife casually commented that I never had any taste, so how would I know the difference? Score one for her. But my mother mandated that we all be vaccinated or we could not visit her. So
and that's fine, and I respect
and we
that.
Did. And they got vaccinated. Both my parents did. My dad, of course, a few months ago passed away at 94, but they got vaccinated and they had no effects. But, she wouldn't let me come near the house until I got vaccinated. So she laid the law down.
Good for her. All right, let's talk about your new book, The Reason Why You're Here, but love chatting with you about Nashville and Chicago. And he's smart, Paul. He got to leave.
7 years ago.
Yes. All right, Near Dark, it's the latest installment in your series. So if you didn't read the first one, can you just jump in with this one?
It's like the Bond movies. You can pick up my latest thriller, and you don't need to have seen a Bond movie before. You don't need to have read one of my previous books. Black Ice, you can jump right in.
All right.
Who's going to play? I mean, when this becomes the new, spy series, who are you going to pick to play?
So it's going to be an A-plus actor. We've actually got a deal with a studio now.
Ooh.
I can't think which studio. I got my first pick director, the biggest action director in Hollywood. Oh. I am thrilled. Got the producers fabulous, the writer. We're just all excited. We got our contracts. And so once all of the contracts are turned back in, the studio is going to do an announcement.
Oh.
And that's the next decision we make as a team is which – and we're going top, like A-plus actor. This
Congratulations.
Is a big budget. Thank you, Paul. They want to compete with Bond and just put Bond back on his heels the way the Bourne franchise did.
Oh,
that's great.
So how long when you sit down to write a novel, Near Dark, how long does that take? And just walk us through your day.
So I do one thriller a year. So each one is longer or shorter depending on how much research I have to do ahead of time. Like I call what I do faction, where you don't know where the facts end and the fiction begins. Mm. In Near Dark, the story is America's top spy. He's got this beautiful Norwegian girlfriend who's in the intelligence business over there. It's mid-July in Oslo.
She should
He's
have
out
been
of vacation
Swedish,
days.
But anyway, I'm fine.
You won't be nominated for any Oscars.
Well, that's true. Norway's a NATO partner, so Sweden isn't.
Okay,
Sweden's kind of half pregnant with
us. All right.
So anyway, he steps out of a cafe and sees a man he killed halfway around the world several years ago, and it starts this big rush that goes all the way up into the Arctic in Norway. Great spy thriller against the real-life backdrop of the U.S. power competition with Russia in the Arctic and how China's been sticking its nose in up there, even though they have no authority to be up there.
Wow. And can you tell us how it ends? No.
It ends with a bang. It's fantastic.
The ending sounds exciting.
Most exciting ending I've ever written.
And if you've ever been up to the fjords, have you ever been up there in Norway? It's gorgeous.
I took my Swedish dad there 2 summers ago. Thank God. Right before COVID, we went to Norway, Sweden, and Denmark.
Did you go to Bergen by any chance?
No, I got a buddy of mine who's a cop in Bergen, and he's like, you're an idiot.
I think it's nicer than Oslo. I mean, if you have to choose
Everybody
between Oslo and Bergen, you go to Bergen. But that's all right. Yep, maybe the next time. Maybe they'll be on location when they shoot this film, right?
from your lips to God's ears, Amy. I like that.
Because I already want to see the movie now. I'll read the book first, but I want to see the movie. All right, but how many hours? So you write one thriller a year. And what's your routine? Can you disclose that? I mean, do you have your own office there, or do you go somewhere to an office?
No, I got my own office here at home, and I get the kids off. I work out in the morning, get the kids off to school, and then I'm in the office and home by 6 for dinner. It's a, Monday through Friday thing, and it's all about seat of pants to seat of chair. And even if I get invited to some swanky golf course like Dan Prof, who I thought the only athleticism he had was the gentleman's triathlon, sauna, steam, and shower.
Well, that's,
I didn't know he actually
that's what everybody does at East Bank Club. I'm doing the biathlon, we call it.
Yeah, well, no offense to the golfers out there. I don't know if I put that into the same category as like extreme sports.
Well, golf?
You're right.
No, he's a good golfer. Brad, do you golf?
No, that's the biggest way. Yeah, what was Rodney Dangerfield's line in Caddyshack?
Biggest waste
golf
of time.
Clubs and country golf clubs and graveyards are the biggest waste of prime real estate.
That's true. And it eats up a whole day. You can't be a parent and play golf, but Dan doesn't. Dan has fictitious children that we joke around about. He has two of them, so he can go out and do what he wants. So, all right, well, Brett, I love your life. I want to have your life. That sounds great. And I like the part, I work out in the morning too, right, when I get off work, but I was with my kids for a year at home. Oh, and I love my children, but that's just way too much time at home. There was no break ever. I would sit in my minivan outside my house and do work just so I could have bandwidth, mm-hmm. because everybody working from home and going to school, you couldn't do it. So that was my routine for almost a year. Isn't that pathetic?
Well, my sons never got time off because they were first responders, of course.
Oh, wow.
In fact, even when they came into contact with individuals who had COVID, they did not quarantine. In fact,
40, they wouldn't let them.
They wouldn't let them. 40% of the police officers, Chicago police officers, actually contracted COVID. So it's been no let up for them. Not only COVID, but 12-hour days, work days, and sometimes going 10, 12 days without a day off. It's been brutal. It's been a brutal 15 months.
At least there hasn't been civil unrest. That would have been difficult.
Oh, yeah, right.
Bad editor.
All right, Brett Thor, I can't wait. The new book is coming in Near Dark. It's now on sale. I shouldn't say it's coming out. It's now on sale.
Black Ice came out yesterday.
Oh, good, good. All right.
Very good.
All right, well, we will buy your books and read it, and I can't wait to see the movie. Thank you so much for joining us. You're awesome.
It's always my pleasure. Keep Chicago strong, you guys.
Okay, we'll try. Thanks. And Brad Thor joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Before you see it on TV, share it on Facebook, or read about it in the paper, hear it here first. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer.